Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This evening I wanted to devote this Dhamma talk to the practice of meditation, to give another how-to sort of talk, to give some basic instructions, to give some insights into the way that we calm our minds down, that we gain one-pointedness, and then enter the absorptions, the jhanas. But in particular in this talk I will be dwelling a lot upon the preparation which we need to do. Much of the success in the practice of meditation, especially samatha meditation, depends upon the preparation and the carefulness by which we get ready the body and the mind, and then we lead it into these profound and beautiful meditation states. The practice which we call samatha means quelling or settling or tranquilizing the mind. Tranquilizing but with full awareness, with very profound awareness, with an awareness which is more clear and more precise than that which we're usually accustomed to. We're going to higher states of consciousness, not to lower states of unconsciousness. And as such, this word samatha, its meaning and its goal becomes one of the first things that we should understand in this path to meditation. Samatha does mean quelling, settling, tranquilizing. If there's any business which needs to be done in a monastery, settling that business, dealing with it so it is done and finished with, is called samatha. It's doing whatever is necessary by whatever means to settle that business. The settling of the business, the calming, the taking something which was once there and allowing it to vanish, is this practice which we call samatha. The more we allow things to vanish, the more we go into deeper states of peacefulness and quietness, and the closer we get to the experience of enlightenment. It's allowing all of these things to cease. Nirodha, cessation. Nirodha, cessation, means that something which was once in existence is no longer in existence. It ceased, it's disappeared. It's disappeared because of those causes which brought it into being and maintained it have now been removed, and so it disappears. You may have noticed in your readings of the suttas, the Buddha's words, that one of the expressions of the goal of this whole practice, one of the terms which the Buddha used to describe the path, or actually the goal of Nibbana, was sabbe sankhara samatha. The samatha-ing, the tranquilizing, the quelling, the settling of all the sankharas, all the conditioned things, settling all of these. Another word for the effect or the result of settling is upasama. And that word comes up, this quietness, this result of settling, in the very well-known little gatha, or little phrase, which we say at every funeral. Anicca vata sankhara upada vaya domino upajita va nirojanti te zang upasamo sukho. That impermanent are all sankharas, all conditioned things. They arise only to pass away. They arise and then they cease. And the upasama, the quietness of those, is happiness, true happiness. So the samatha is the tranquilizing, and the upasama is the result, the tranquility, the settling. And the whole goal of this path or this practice is expressed in one way by the Buddha as the quietening of all the sankharas, sabbe sankhara samatha. But the Buddha also said that for people who are still delighting in the world of the five senses, they can't even understand or contemplate the meaning of the quietening of all sankharas. It's just beyond their understanding that this could be a goal, or this could be happiness, or this could be nibbana. Understanding, or just bearing in mind that sabbe sankhara samatha, the samatha-ing, the quelling, the settling of all sankharas, is actually the goal of nibbana, gives a good context to the practice of samatha which we do in our meditation. It's taking all of these disturbances, the coarser and grosser sankharas, the things which arise because of causes and are sustained because of causes, finding those causes and abandoning them, letting them go, relinquishing them. Because once they're relinquished, once the causes are gone, the effect disappears and the thing is quelled. So what are we trying to quell in our meditation? The part of samatha. First of all, what we're trying to quell is the restlessness of the body, and then the restlessness of the mind. The restlessness of the body is first of all quiet in its coarser form by sitting it down, or by laying it down, or by putting it in a posture of standing or walking where it's restrained, where it cannot go where it would normally want to roam. You're restraining it. This restraint is necessary at first, just to give a coarse settling to the disturbance of the body. However, the body, even though it's sitting down on a comfortable seat, even though it's laying down on a soft bed, one notices that the body has no end of discomfort. And the only way to quell and settle that discomfort is to turn one's attention away. One settles the body in a reasonable, comfortable position. And once it is settled in that position, one has to turn the attention away from the physical body. Turning the attention away from the physical body means turning the attention away from that fifth sense, the sense of touch, concerning with the aches, pains, heats, cold, itches and whatever inside of the body. You'll find that if one turns the attention away long enough, turns it on to the feeling of the breath, turns it on to the practice of loving kindness or metta, or turns it away onto some other object of meditation, you find that after a very short time the feelings in the body disappear. But one becomes not attentive to those feelings in the body. And the body calms down. The body gets its first taste of prasadi of tranquility. And that tranquility, that tranquilizing of the body, results in the peace of the body, where the body does not move, it does not twitch, it does not rock. And the mind can put all of its attention to the meditation object rather than fighting this battle to get comfortable, rather than attending to the endless needs of this physical body. This has to be the first part of the tranquil meditation which we do, to tranquilizing the body, to settling it down. Once that settling is achieved, the first bit of prasadi, the reason why one can maintain that tranquility of the body is because it is a very happy state to be in. Once the body disappears, once one isn't concerned with the business of trying to gain comfort and ease in the body, a sort of happiness arises in the mind. It's good to know that sort of happiness when the body disappears, because it gives one an indication of the sort of piti-sukha which we're talking about as jhana factors. This piti-sukha is not a jhana factor yet, but it is of the type. It is of the sort which is one of the constituents of a jhana. It's it's of the sort because it is a happiness, an ease, which arises because an irritation, a burden, a difficulty has been abandoned. Something which was suffering has been let go of, and there's a resultant sense of ease, freedom. It is the joy of freedom. Freedom from concern with the body. And this is one of the first freedoms one can notice. The word freedom in Pali is vimutti, having been freed from something. Freed from something which was a burden, a pain, a difficulty, a problem. At this point in one's meditation, I can encourage you just to pause and reflect on the word freedom, and reflect on the piti-sukha born of that freedom. Because one is getting an idea of the piti-sukha and the freedoms which the Buddha was talking about. If one does pause and reflect upon these things, one is practicing vipassana. One is practicing this insight into these qualities, these phenomena which arise in the mind. And I like to point this out now because the practice of meditation, even though I call it samatha, because that's what I emphasize, it will always include vipassana, the insight and understanding into the phenomena and their causes and their way they disappear in the mind. You cannot do one without the other. The only reason which I emphasize samatha over vipassana is because samatha gives one much clearer, much more defined signposts along the way. If one makes samatha one's goal, then one will know how far one has achieved, how far one has gone along the journey, because the development of samatha is easy to recognize. The development of vipassana, of insight, is much more difficult. To assess how much insight you're getting, how would you know? The little insights, the seeing into the nature of things which one thinks one has, very often in the nature of the Buddhist practice, people think it's insight when it's still delusion. Wisdom is very hard to understand and to know. because of avijja. But samatha has got very clearly defined signposts. And that's why I like to encourage samatha, because you know you're getting somewhere, or you know you're not. And as you push on towards the goals of samatha, you will by necessity have to be developing the insights as well, and some very important insights, such as what I was just saying, the nature of what we mean by vimutti or freedom in its coarser levels, and the nature of the piti sukha born of that freedom. So one reflects and sees and experiences the piti sukha once the body disappears, and one realizes this is a freedom from the body. But one is still stuck with this mind, and this mind is a mind which still wanders and thinks and contemplates and worries and gets upset and frustrated and gets excited. This is a mind which is still far from being settled. And the job of this meditation now comes to settling this mind. The only way that one can settle this mind is to take hold of a meditation object. And taking hold of a meditation object means one chooses something for the attention to dwell upon, to lean towards. And dwelling and leaning towards this as much as one can, eventually to the point where the attention merges with that object and becomes one with it, and continues to remain one with that object. When the mind sustains itself on that object. Now that whole process, from starting with a mind which is diffuse, which is all over the place, which is being dragged away on all sorts of different byways and interesting ideas and concepts which come up from time to time, to be able to go from there to a mind which just stays on one thing is a very difficult thing to do. And this becomes the main area of our practice in the monastery, to be able to know that path from diffuse mind to a one-pointed mind, to know it very well, so well that we can take that path whenever we wish and gain samadhi, the sustained awareness on one thing, with ease, without difficulty, and at will. We choose an object, but we have to have some skills in order to be able to maintain our awareness on that object. And it is those skills which we develop throughout our monastic life, not just in meditation, throughout our monastic life, which really come to bear at this point in the practice of samatha meditation. The practice of samatha meditation becomes successful not just because one is skilled in sitting meditation, but it becomes successful because one is skilled in living monastic life as a whole. The whole of the training of monastic life comes to bear in this practice of sitting meditation and quietening the mind. And to see that relationship between the monastic life, the rules of vinaya, the korwat, the traditions, the dhamma, and to see that all come together and to propel the mind into tranquility, becomes a very moving and profound and powerful experience. Just to see the great skill and deep wisdom of the Buddha, the way he set this all up. The first thing which one needs to be able to quieten that mind down is the lack of remorse. The lack of remorse because one has lived a good life. That living a good life is not just since the time one is born. It can be just living that good life today. if one has acted in a lazy way, if one has said something one should not have said, done something one should not have done, ignored or broken a rule, small or large, of the Vinaya, that the mind will not feel happy. The mind will not feel free. It will be bound up by the fetter of remorse. And sometimes that one can see this in one's meditation. Why some days is a meditation good? Why is it not so good other days? It can be just little things which one feels bad about, because one was slack, because one backslid, because one did something which one knows one shouldn't have done. The whole purpose here of the Vinaya, of the rules, of the training, is to make that remorse just so impossible, so unlikely, so that when one sits meditation, there's no old karma from so far today or yesterday or the beginning of the rains retreat which can come up and bother the mind. If one looks at all about what one has done, one looks with joy and happiness. One looks and sees that one has done a good service. One has done good karma, generous, good acts. And this absence of remorse and the presence of this opposite, this wholesome karma, is something which I encourage everyone to develop and to turn to it at this stage in the meditation. It's not just absence of remorse, but the joy that there's absence of remorse, that one has spent one's time well, one has got up early in the morning, one has sat, one has given up something, whether it's given up a breakfast or given up coming out to talk to people, giving up reading newspapers, giving up whatever. Reflect upon that, remember it, and allow it to bring you joy, satisfaction, that you've done that which is worthy of doing. You've done something noble, whether it's having swept the grounds, whether it's vacuumed the carpet in here, whether it's served the monks with their breakfast, whether it's washed the dishes, to reflect that not only is absence of remorse, but one has spent one's time doing that which is good. One has made merit. And that reflection at this time, the absence of remorse and the presence of the memory of meritorious actions, makes the mind soft and workable for the practice of meditation. It brings happiness and joy to the mind. It brings energy and power to the mind. So the absence of remorse and the presence of the good energy born of having performed merit is important here. It is why that sometimes that some of the teachers, the Kuba Ajahn in Thailand, sometimes say that some monks, some lay people, some practitioners have got the ability to gain jhanas. They've got the parami, the accumulated talent born from some past actions. And here you can, as it were, get hold of that paramita. If one hasn't got much paramita in this area, one can take what one has and, as it were, amplify it, use it in this way, just by gathering it up and reflecting upon it, and allow it to purify the mind of remorse and bring up good energy. Once the mind is joyful and energetic, you find then it is reasonably easy to develop what Venerable Ajahn Yanadhamma was talking about the other night, the iddhipadas. Like sometimes the iddhipadas, these four paths to success or paths to power, sometimes that they're very hard to generate. If they're already there, it's very easy to generate them. It's a strange thing that you may wish to generate these things, and sometimes just the mind is just too stiff. I would suggest that this is the time to generate these things. Once the mind has reflected on the past and got some energy already up through lack of remorse for having lived a good life, then you'll find it's reasonably easy to develop the four Iddhipadas. The Iddhipadas of Chanda, the will or desire for a goal, the energy which is caught up and bound up with the achieving that goal, and the citta, the application of the mind towards that goal, and the vimamsa, the use of the faculty of wisdom and investigation, contemplation, in order to achieve that goal. All of these things, if they are going to be successful, need to be sustained. But of course, before they're sustained, they need to be aroused. And one of the prerequisites to them being aroused is to have a goal clearly in mind. If the goal isn't clearly in mind, one suffers from the hindrance of doubt. The hindrance of doubt in the context of the four Iddhipadas means, first of all, the Iddhipadas are pointing in one direction, then in another, then somewhere else, as the mind vacillates between its goals. One moment aiming for over here, the next moment aiming for somewhere else. The Iddhipadas will not be come to any fruition, if they're always aiming in different places. One needs the goal, first of all, and then the Iddhipadas, the desire or will, energy, application of the mind and investigation, have something to work on. And they have something, some goal, on which they can sustain their force. And if one sustains those Iddhipadas on that goal and keeps that goal clearly in mind without any doubt, knowing that this is going to be the path into jhanas, and one wants to achieve those jhanas, it does become one's goal. One has no doubt about their worth and their value, and one makes it a very clear goal, then the Iddhipadas have something to work with and they become successful. So the goals which we make for ourselves in this practice of meditation become very important. You gain success by having goals and desiring to achieve them using these four Iddhipadas. If you give up desire, then you'll just wander around like a person who is blind, vagrant, doesn't know where they're going, doesn't know what to do. So the desire, the goals in this meditation on the breath or on any other object, I describe as follows. The first goal should be where the mind can sustain its awareness on the object, not fully but partially. If the object is the breathing, the first goal with which one applies the Iddhipadas, the first goal should be sustained awareness on each in-breath and each out-breath, so that one knows each in-breath, each out-breath, one after the other, for maybe 100 or 200 breaths in succession without missing one. To be able to sustain the awareness to this extent is not that difficult. It still gives the mind the opportunity to think, to wander around, but it hasn't got too much space to wander around. After it's noted one in-breath, it can wander around only so far. It has to come back in time to catch the next out-breath. It can go wandering again, but has to come back to catch the next in-breath. What you're doing is restraining the wandering mind. It can go away, but not too far and not too long. This should be the first goal if one is doing the breath meditation. If one is doing walking meditation, the goal shouldn't be able to notice every step, left foot, right foot. Again, it gives the mind the opportunity to wander off, but not too far. It has to come back in time to be aware of the next step. The Iddhipadas, the four roads to power, should be applied on this goal. As they are applied on this goal, one understands that to be able to sustain the desire to achieve this goal, there is a very important factor which needs to be present, and that is mindfulness, sati. The mindfulness which has two functions. If you ever go into the Abhidhamma, you'll find it's got some very good things in the Abhidhamma. There's some things which I think are going over the top. Everyone has their opinions on the Abhidhamma, but part of the useful things which I have found in my practice in the Abhidhamma is to see that these things define not so much by what they are, but by what they do. Defining a quality in the mind by its function. And mindfulness, you don't ask what mindfulness is, you ask what mindfulness does. And what mindfulness does is two things. Mindfulness, first of all, informs you of the content of your consciousness, informs you what's there, so you know what you are doing. That's the first function of mindfulness. You know whether you are watching the breath or whether you're doing something else. So often that people, meditators, don't even know if they're watching the breath or if they're thinking about the breath or if they're going somewhere else and thinking about something else. The mindfulness for this meditation has to be very precise and clear. And that mindfulness can be developed, this precision and clarity of what you are doing throughout the day in monastic life. Every opportunity, every moment, every activity is an opportunity for precise and clear awareness of what you are doing, where you are, what the content of your consciousness is. And the more times we take the opportunity to develop mindfulness in our daily life, to develop the ability to be precise and clear about what we're doing and the content of our consciousness from moment to moment as we're walking backwards and forwards between the hall and the dining room or our huts or the ablution block, whatever we are doing, you'll find that when one meditates, the opportunity for this mindfulness which informs you of what you're doing, you find that mindfulness in meditation is strong and clear. You do know what you're doing. And then you find you can apply the Iddhipadas, you can sustain them. You actually know whether you're doing them or not. The second function of mindfulness, which is most important, the first one is knowing what you're doing. The second one is knowing what you're supposed to be doing. It's the aspect of mindfulness which is memory, which remembers the instructions. And that aspect of mindfulness is very important if one is going to achieve these goals. You have to remember the instructions, you have to remember the goal, you have to remember the Iddhipadas, you have to remember how. You have to know where you're going. to develop this memory, this keeping the instructions clearly in mind as you go along this path towards this goal, again, is something which we practice throughout our monastic life. We listen to the Dhamma. We contemplate the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the path, is the map. We hear the instructions. And if we listen to the instructions with clear attention, they tend, as it were, to get branded in the mind. They tend to stick very clearly. So that when we have to sit by ourselves in our huts, we know, we remember. I used to be a school teacher, and I know from the ways of teaching children to remember. One of the best ways to teach a child to remember something is to get them to write it down again and again 100 times. The reason why the child remembers that, if they have to write it down 100 times, because it takes so much effort to write it again and again. The more effort means the more care. The more care, the more mindfulness. The more mindfulness, the more we remember. So whenever one is listening to the Dhamma or reading the Dhamma, do it with clear mindfulness, with attention. Put effort into listening, effort into reading, effort into understanding. And the instructions will be very clearly and deeply embedded in one's mind. And they come up when one meditates. One knows what to do. If one has difficulty keeping the instructions in mind, one very useful tool which I've used is at the beginning of this particular stage in the meditation, I make resolutions. Simple things, that I will watch the breath, or I will not allow the mind to wander off. I will pay attention to the experience of breath rather than the commentary about the breath. And I make those resolutions not once, but 3 times clearly to myself, with as much effort, carefulness as I possibly can muster. And it's as if that continues echoing throughout the next 5 minutes of my meditation. I remember what I'm supposed to be doing. And it's always there reminding me. This is the second function of sati, to keep you in the right direction by reminding you of what you're supposed to be doing. And with these 2 functions of mindfulness, in knowing what you're doing and remembering what you're supposed to be doing, and the idipadas, the desire to achieve your goal, the energy to achieve the goal, and the application of the mind onto the goal, and the investigation, you have the great chance to achieve that goal. You should achieve that goal. And once that first goal is reached, you have the sustained awareness on each in-breath and out-breath. And that should bring one joy and happiness. One has achieved something. And one could even pause there and to see what one has left behind. One has left behind a lot of the mind which goes and seeks for its pleasures in the world of the 5 senses, which wanders around the past and the future, family and friends, old times, things which might be. You've left a lot of that behind. Pause and notice that's vimutti, that's a freedom. Then reflect and know through your experience of how that mind, which is not wandering too far, feels. It's a mind which is beginning to appreciate peace and the happiness of peace. And then you take the second goal on. The second goal being the full awareness on the meditation object. The full awareness being the ability to sustain your attention without a pause, from the very beginning of each in-breath to the end of each in-breath, beginning of the out-breath to the end of the out-breath, continually following the experience of breath, that which tells you where the, what the breath is doing. So you know the breath is going in, you know the breath is going in, is going in, is going in, is going in, it stopped going in, starting going out, without naming it or having a commentary to it, just knowing it just through bare experience, this continual sustained awareness on the object. When this is achieved, the second goal is achieved, the mind has no opportunity to go very far at all. In fact, all it can really dwell upon is the object itself. All it can really think about is the object itself. The vitaka, vichara, the thought is just around the object of the breath. And you've released the mind from so much at this point. You've released it from the coarser of the five hindrances. And the last step, if we wish to go into a jhana, once one has achieved that state and stopped and just reflected for a while on the happiness and peace of it, that one has calmed down many sankharas so far. To carry on from there, we have to calm the object itself. Before, we've just been calming the mind, calming other things outside of the object of meditation. Now we calm the object itself. Even the breath at this stage is too coarse to enter a jhana. We have to calm this breath down. This becomes a very subtle stage of the meditation, but it's a waste of time talking and thinking about this stage until one has reached stage two and has some skill in getting this far. Once one has got the skill to get to stage two, then one can start calming the breath down. One does this in a number of ways. Sometimes just by a suggestion, just be calm. Sometimes by a little word like just let go, let be. Sometimes by a reflection on anatta, again using vipassana, wisdom. Realizing that there's no one controlling all of this. So I'm not going to give any orders. I'm going to completely let go and allow the breath to calm by itself. Indeed, it is the nature of such sankhara to calm down if they're left alone. Again, one of the causes, all these sankhara, they arise because of a cause, and they're sustained because of a cause. That coarseness of the breath is only sustained because of the sense of self which wants to control the breath, which wants to control the body. And sometimes in one's meditation one can come across the time when the breath appears to be unstable. And you can see then it's just the mind wanting to control it. Let it go, leave it alone. And it will settle down by itself. So whether it's just making the suggestion to settle down, whether it's making the suggestion to let go, whether it's making the suggestion just to no control, noticing just anatta. Don't notice anicca here, because anicca, the impermanence, the reflection on impermanence here, the anicca sanya, will lead to diversity of the mind. That reflection on anicca will go against the path into jhana here. The mind will just notice the diversity. The same with do not notice dukkha here. Do not turn the mind to that aspect of the experience, because if one turns the mind to dukkha at this point, the mind will harden up. You can turn it to anatta, non-self. That is a skillful means here to go into a jhana. As the mind, as the objects of one's meditation, the breath, starts to calm down, it changes. At this point, please remember that one will still be watching the breath. Keep the mindfulness very clear. I think the Buddha did say the meditation on the breath is very difficult for this reason, because the breath keeps on changing. Perhaps it's more accurate to say it's not the breath which keeps on changing, but the perception of this breath which keeps on changing. What you're mindful of here is just the perception of breath. And as the breath becomes more refined, so does the perception start to change. It moves from the realm of the physical feeling to the realm of the mind. There are six senses, you may remember, at the second stage of this meditation, that the awareness of the breath is the awareness usually of the feeling of the breath, of the bodily feeling. To gain the jhana, one has to move from that fifth sense into the sixth sense of the mind. It's the way the mind perceives this breath. This is a process which happens naturally as the breath calms down. The coarser aspects of the breath start to disappear, revealing those aspects of the breath which are more refined. The coarser aspect is a physical feeling. The more refined aspect is the mental experience of breath. For those of you who have little experience yet of the world of the mind, who have little experience of jhanas, the ability to appreciate the world of the mind apart from the other five senses is very difficult to appreciate. The world of the mind for the novice is a very strange place. It throws up many interesting, fascinating, weird and wonderful images. After a while, one gets used to these things. One neither gets excited nor afraid. This is just the world of the mind. But it is a subtle world, a very refined world. And if we live a lot of our life in the coarse outside world, sometimes we're a bit too rough around the edges to really appreciate and understand the world of just mind. But here we have to come and understand the world of just mind, where the mental image of the breath becomes prominent. To be able to sustain the awareness on that mental image of the breath when you have no familiarity with the mental world can sometimes be difficult. You're not quite sure what you're doing. You're not quite sure whether this is the mental image or not. Be careful here. The mental image will appear to you in many different ways. But remember that that mental image of the breath will have certain features which you should look out for. This sati, which remembers the instructions. If you remember this instruction, that the mental image has certain main features, and you notice those features, you will have the opportunity to enter the jhana. The mindfulness here is very important, the mindfulness which remembers. The main feature here is the peace and happiness, the piti sukha, born of vimutti, born of a freedom. In the text they say it's born of viveka, born of seclusion. Seclusion is having freed oneself from that which is entangling, that which is noisy. One is secluded, moved away from the world of houses and families and Buddhist societies, even moved away from dining rooms and food and kitchens and people and gone into one's hut. This is seclusion. Freedom from all of that busyness down below there. The freedom of the mind from all the busyness of the body, all the busyness of thought, all the busyness concerned with the problems, the desires and aversions of the five sense world. You've left that and you've gone just to mind. This is viveka, citta viveka, the seclusion in the mind. The freedom, the first of the freedoms which the Buddha was talking about. And once the mind frees itself and notices these mental images and notices the main feature, which is it's just attractive peace and happiness. This is not the peace and happiness of the world, it's a different type of peace and happiness. It's a peace and happiness of seclusion, the peace of happiness, of freedom, of having let go of a burden. If you know the peace and the happiness when the body disappears, you're getting an inkling of what I mean. If you know the peace and happiness when you get to this first stage in the meditation, when all the problems with lust and hatred and worrying about this and that disappear, you get some idea of the peace and happiness I'm talking about. You know the peace and happiness of the second stage when you're free of the mind wandering and you just got this breath in mind and nothing else. You get some idea of the peace and happiness of this third stage in jhanas. And once you know it, and once you appreciate that this is peace, this is happiness, once you recognize what I sometimes call the beautiful breath, then you're just on the edge of jhana. You're on the edge because once you've recognized it, the mind will go towards it. Whether you like it or not, without you saying anything, without you making any effort, any choice, because the mind recognizes a very beautiful and very lovely abiding, it will go to it. It will go to it and stay there because the mind enjoys that happiness. And it doesn't wish, the mind doesn't wish to leave. It stays there. It sustains its attention because of the happiness and peace, the bliss. It is a mind which is feeding on bliss. That is its ahara. That is its sustenance in this state. In this state, the mind will not be able to think, to make choices, to exercise its will. The only thing which the mind will be able to do is just, as it were, to circle around the object, getting in close, going away a little bit, getting closer again. There's the natural attraction to the object, getting really close, but then because there's just a very refined restlessness still remaining in the mind, it will go away and it will go close again and go away again. As one perceives that experience will be because of one's past conditioning. But hopefully there'll be enough sati in there to notice the main feature. This is bliss. This is happiness. This is a happiness which is much more wonderful than the happiness of a wandering mind, than the happiness of the world of the five senses. If it knows that, it will stay there. As it stays there, the mind is resting. The mind is being empowered. The mind is feeding on this joy and getting strong. And when it emerges in the mind's own time, when it's ready according to its own causes, you emerge out of that jhana. And you emerge out of that jhana, if it is a true state of jhana, with a coarser type of joy, but still a sort of joy which brings great joy and happiness and tears, as it were, to the eyes. A knowledge that you've been in a refined state of mind. Mahagata, the mind gone to a great state. These are Mahagata Dhammas, the jhanas. And that joy and happiness which come up afterwards, you should be careful of that. Because that can break up the state too quickly and take one back to the ordinary state of mind. It can rouse the hindrances. Be careful of that. And instead just spend a few moments reflecting. Instead of just getting blissed out, wow, at last, marvelous, I've done it, great. This was marvelous, this is what the Buddha was talking about. Just stop for a while and just look back where one has been. At the very edges of the territory, just before one moves, one can, as it were, glance back and see that whole realm of the first jhana. And just spending a short while doing the Pachawekana, just reflecting backwards on where one has just been, one gains the insight, the vipassana on the nature of first jhana. Understands what first jhana is, what its qualities are, what its features are. And it's important that one knows these things, at least this degree of sankhara samatha. You're getting to know the mind. You're getting to know the nature of a mind in a very profound but very useful state. A state which, if you know the state of the mind first jhana, it makes the states of the mind outside of jhana, it gives much more information, much more understanding of what the Buddha's Dharma was. You're getting a very powerful vipassana, the nature of a state which is sukha, as against other states which are dukkha. And this whole path of understanding, what else is it but understanding what dukkha is and what sukha is? And you do not understand dukkha and sukha just by theorizing and by thinking it all out. You understand these things by experience. And if you understand the experience of a first jhana, then you understand outside of a first jhana. You're understanding a lot about sukha and dukkha, which many people just haven't got the foggiest idea about. You're understanding it because you've been there. So you reflect upon this experience. And as you reflect upon the experience, once you get that ability to reflect, start it up, you can continue on taking one of the objects of anicca, dukkha or anatta, the impermanence, unsatisfactory non-self. And you'll find that the mind will have so much power, you'll have so much penetration, that you start to understand those words, the meaning of those words, much more deeply, more profoundly, more powerfully than you could ever have done before. Here you are doing the vipassana, the insight practice which leads to Magga-Pala, which leads to the stages of enlightenment. You've got the mind which is powerful. So, having emerged from one of these jhanas, just spend a few moments reflecting on where one has been, knowing it. And then, afterwards, reflect on anicca, dukkha, anatta. Reflect upon it on the five khandhas especially. The things which make up this body and mind. First of all, knowing what the five khandhas really are. Only when the mind is powerful can you really see these things. You may have some idea of what the body is, some idea of what feeling, perception, chaitanya, sati is, some idea of what consciousness is. But when the mind has emerged from a jhana, when one is in upachara samadhi, I like the word upachara samadhi applied to the state post jhana, because this is where upachara samadhi lasts and is very strong. The five hindrances are gone, they're knocked out cold and they won't get up again for a while. This is a time when the mind is strong and powerful and you can really start to see what the five khandhas are, how they arise, where they go to, and how to escape from them. You're getting the enlightenment wisdoms. And the next time that one wishes to go into a first jhana, because one has reflected just at the other edge, just as one is coming out, one knows the experience, one knows the feeling, one knows the nimitta of the jhana. If you know the nimitta very well, you've spent much time in the first jhana and you've spent much time just on the edge before you come out, looking back, you'll know that experience so well. It'll be such familiar territory that you'll be able to get back in there very easily. Sometimes you'll be able to get in there just by remembering the nimitta, calling it to mind. And as you call it to mind, the mind recognizes a dear old friend and just goes to it without needing to go through any stages or take up breath or do whatever. It's the mind, because of its familiarity, will just go straight into a jhana and will remain in it. This is the path of samatha as far as first jhana. Obviously the samatha goes much further. It goes second, third, fourth. It goes to the paths and fruits. It goes to enlightenment. As I said at the beginning, sabbe sankhara samatha, or the way of quelling, tranquilizing all the sankharas, was a way the Buddha described nibbana. And this is quelling a lot of them. This is going a great distance on the journey by doing this samatha practice. It's not in contradistinction to vipassana. Vipassana comes along all the way. These two go hand in hand, but I stress samatha because it's easier to find one's way with samatha. And if one just tries doing vipassana and one hasn't got any samatha, it means the vipassana is not being done. If it is true vipassana, it leads to samatha. If it's true samatha, it leads to vipassana. And these two go together, and they go deep. So this is all I wish to say this evening, and I will continue this talk next week with some more instructions on going deeper in samatha meditation and also its twin vipassana. Is there any question or comments anyone would like to ask about the talk which I've given this evening? Yes.
I think it's quite interesting to notice that there's Piti Sukha before jhana, because it can be easily mistaken for jhana proper, or even be taught that way, or be called vipassana jhana, things like that.
You are saying that you find it interesting that there's Piti Sukha before jhana, and that sometimes that's mistaken for jhana, it's taught as jhana, and it's sometimes taught as vipassana jhana. again, the Buddha never used the word vipassana jhana. So if the Buddha never used it, I don't think it's a valid category. However, what you're saying is true. There is piti sukha, which comes prior to a jhana, and also after a jhana, when one comes out. And that piti sukha is of a coarse type. One can notice just by understanding samatha as being a quietening, a tranquilizing, a settling meditation, that anything which is so disturbing as a piti sukha, which can sometimes arise before jhana or after jhana, cannot be the result of samatha, but is an obstacle to samatha. So that piti sukha, which can sometimes arise and be very disturbing, needs to be settled down, needs to be tranquilized. And again, the way that one tranquilizes these things is to not give them so much interest. They arise by a cause and they will go away if you remove that cause. And the cause which sustains them and nourishes them is our interest in them. Again, if one has familiarity with jhanas and one knows that this isn't the real thing and there's something which is more profound, that one will be able to let go of those and go to a peaceful state. Settle the mind. Anything which appears to you as disturbing, settle it. Settle and settle and settle. That's why that sometimes that describing piti sukha as rapture and joy and bliss can sometimes be misleading. Sometimes it might be better to describe it as just immense peace, profound stillness. Because those sorts of words are describing one of the aspects of that experience which could be all that one sees at first, until one realizes that this is great happiness and great piti as well. Like the Buddha said, Nibbana paramang sukhang, that Nibbana is the ultimate sukha and happiness, where Nibbana is nothing to be felt, nothing to be perceived. Then for many people, how can that be happiness? Something ultimately peaceful and silent. And it's only when one appreciates even the jhanas, just the happiness, the bliss of a jhana is just so peaceful, so silent, profoundly so, one gets an idea of why the ultimate peace and silence of Nibbana can be ultimate happiness.
Should one stick with the breath when this piti sukha arises?
You're asking that when that piti sukha arises, should one stick with the breath? I would say at this point, be careful. If it's a piti sukha which is disturbing, which is of a coarse quality, then stay with the breath. Keep the breath in the center and allow that piti sukha just to roam around the outside. But keep the mind centered on the breath. And if you keep the mind centered on the breath, then that piti sukha should just quiet itself down and become sort of a more profound piti sukha. This is where it's the skill in meditation is most important. You have to recognize these objects for yourself and to know them very well, and to know whether this is a piti sukha which will lead into a jhana or a piti sukha which will obstruct a jhana. What I'm saying there is like keeping the attention on the breath in the middle and even this thing on the outside. If it's something which obstructs, it will go away. If it's something which will help, it will stick around. and all the time you keep that the Iddipadas just aiming at this point on stillness, tranquility, settling. That becomes the goal. See how deeply one can settle the mind. That's like just a whisper in the background, which is always pointing you. Wherever in that territory is more peaceful, wherever in that territory there's less wind to disturb the mind, one goes there. Does that answer your question in enough detail? You had a question. If you consciously stop thought while you're on the breath, where do you go from there? The consciously stopping of thought is the stopping of the coarser form of thought, which is like the verbalizing thought. And very often one is just really suppressing it, and if one just takes the thumb off for a short while, it'll just come up again. It's extremely useful to do, and I'll encourage you to do that as a means to get deeper. Once the thought, the coarse thought, the verbal thought has been overcome, you'll find that the mind will still be moving. This is like the mind which you see here is like the chaitanya, the movement of the mind, the activity of the mind, which pushes it to this or to that, but subverbally, and before the mind breaks into speech. And this is the vitakka vichara of first jhana, where you see, we feel, experience the mind still moving. It hasn't settled down yet to a point to where it has no space. It's still got an area where it wanders around, only a very small area, and it's just within the boundaries of speech. So the speech is outside of it. So once you have sort of suppressed or overcome that thought, then you've got to make sure that the object which is left there gets settled down to the point where it's attractive and beautiful enough that even though you take the thumb off and you don't suppress thought any longer, the mind will not go to thinking because it's already seen something more beautiful which will absorb it and entrance it. So that's how I would suggest you proceed from the point of having overcome thought. Pay attention to that meditation object. Settle it down to become so beautiful, so attractive, so peaceful, that the attention just goes in there and it doesn't want to come out. Okay, I think that's enough for this evening.